You're listening to The Word from Westwood, a series of podcasts featuring sermons preached at Westwood United Methodist Church in Los Angeles, California.
My daughter Elizabeth recently started her master's in social work program over at that fine university that is the home of the Trojans. Now, we're just going to agree right now we're not talking about football anymore, correct? It comes as no surprise that much of her early coursework has been delving deeply into family systems and the effect that families have upon successive generations. Now, I was looking over this chart the other day that she had created that's called a genograph, something before that day that I had never heard of. And it looks at three generations in particular of family linkages and what emerges on this are particular genetic traits, relational lines, things that seem to be passed from one generation to the next. And it served as a very visual reminder of how interconnected we humans can become, not only because of our genetics, but because of our social conditioning. Now, I suppose this also hits me at that time of year when the concept of family always seems to be in the forefront of consciousness. And I know that's the same for many of you. And when I might ask myself why, the response really is one that's not a great surprise. It's pretty much the same thing going on in life as it is at the church during this season of autumn. Not that we ever really experience that in Southern California anymore. It's a time where things seem to be packed and concentrated into a very short period, and it's exactly the same in the church. We do more in these next 3 months than we probably do the other 9 months of the year. It's something that's also implanted in us, I believe, culturally, because this harvest season, as it used to be thought of, is a time that represented the shortening of days, more time spent in community, more time spent in family. So it's really no surprise that our thoughts turn to family at this particular time of year. Now, anytime we explore an ancient Hebrew story, as we have this morning, we encounter family systems. We encounter these family systems complete with all of their intrigue as well as their triumph. It really is never possible for us to completely understand the overarching covenant story over all the Hebrew narrative unless we understand human connections and how they impact each of us. The story of Sarah and Abraham, for example, is a story of family. The experiences that surrounded Moses and the movement of the children of Israel from captivity to their desert wandering to ultimate settlement really is a story about family connection. Now, our text this morning comes from an era that might be somewhat unfamiliar to us, the time of the judges. And this was the time immediately after the wilderness wanderings of the children of Israel, that time that they had spent under Moses' leadership in the Sinai desert, because after that they arrived and they settled in the land of Canaan. But let's not forget, folks, that there were already people there in Canaan. The land was taken over by many a bloody battle. Families were interrupted as well as families beginning. Now, that region was divided among what were considered to be the 12 tribes of Israel, representing the 12 sons of Jacob. Yes, indeed, gender bias was at work big time. But to get even more specific, only 11 of the tribes received land allotment. The Levites, who were the people that became the priests, they were supposed to be supported by the other 11 tribes. You see, that's the origins of kept clergy. It's really very ancient in our understanding. Now, during this period of the judges, there were many, many interesting stories that emerged. You might remember the one about Samson and Delilah. Well, the book of Ruth, only 4 chapters, so I really encourage you to take the time to read the whole thing, is a work from this period, a time that predates the creation of the kingdom of Israel. Now, when we look at Ruth, we do need to realize that on many levels, it is a story about family, pure and simple. Now, while the name of the book of Ruth may be familiar, it's probably a bad assumption to think that we all know the story. So let me give you what I would refer to as the Cliff Notes version of the story. In fact, I asked my kids yesterday, does Cliff Notes mean anything to anybody anymore? And they said, yes, it does. So for once, I don't feel too antique or ancient. So the action starts in Bethlehem, of all places. Naomi and Elimelech, as we heard, are married to each other, and they had two sons, Malon and Kilian. A famine hits. They move to Moab, which is on the other side of the Jordan Valley, the other side of the Dead Sea. And then after they'd been in Moab a time, tragedy hit. Elimelech died, leaving Naomi a widow with her two sons. Well, the two sons, as we know, got married. They got married to Orpah and to Ruth. And unfortunately, these three women were in a very sad situation when now Malon and Kilian also died. We have three widows. Naomi was now in a place where her two daughters-in-law, where she was a stranger, she was a foreigner. And her husband and her sons, that which would represent security in that ancient culture, were now deceased. So friends, this was not a good scenario then, just as it's really a hard scenario for us today, if we imagine that. In fact, it was a scenario that for them was probably very frightening. Well, after a time, we know that Naomi decided that she was going to return to the region of Judah, to the city of Bethlehem, her place of origin. So she began this journey with both Ruth and Orpah, but she quickly decided to tell the women, go back to your homes. Don't stay with me. Go restart your lives. There's really not much hope for me, so I'm just going to head back to my place of origin. And we know that there were considerable tears and conversation that took place. And ultimately, Orpah left to go back to Moab. But it became clear that Ruth was having none of that, that she was going to accompany Naomi back to Bethlehem. And this is where we heard what I hope is a familiar text to us, where you go, I will go. Your people shall be my people, your God, my God. Now, if that's not a statement of family connection, I don't know what is. Ruth and Naomi made their way back to Bethlehem, and they arrived in time for the barley harvest. Now, this is when the story gets really interesting, and it was not in the lection to be read today, but you need to know that when they get out there, it turns out that Naomi had a wealthy relative on her husband's side who was named Boaz. And this is where a little bit of a plot started to be hatched, a plot saying, how are we going to find security when we're in a very insecure situation? And so this plot between Naomi and Ruth turned out to be something where Naomi decided she wanted to set Ruth up with Boaz, because this seemed to be the best way for them to have security, because frankly, nobody else was going to be looking out for them. So first, she said, you're going to go out into the barley fields and do some gleaning, which was grunt work. It meant you were looking through all the leftover stuff in order to find something out of which to sustain yourself. And the hope was that in this process that Ruth and Boaz would meet. Well, to shorten the story, yes, they did meet, just as hoped. And after this, Naomi, and this is the part where I don't think it's even PG, it starts to get R at this point. Naomi advised Ruth to go to Boaz after he had finished eating and drinking and was retiring for the night. And the instruction was to go and uncover his feet and lie down. Now, this is a perfect example of something being lost in translation, folks. In the Old Testament language, the uncovering of feet was a euphemism for uncovering Boaz's genitals, pure and simple. Now, that's something that doesn't sound quite too genteel in the English, so it's somewhat avoided and a euphemism stuck in its place. Like I said, a scheme is at work, but we also need to remember the culture of the day. This was the only way these women were going to find security for themselves. Imagine that you had no other way to find family or security. Well, the plot further thickens with some machinations surrounding inheritance and Naomi's property and who it belonged to, and ultimately Boaz married Ruth. It seemed the right thing to do both economically and culturally. Happy ending, in other words. Then to make this story take on some more importance than it really should garner, the epilogue has some important little points in it. Remember the city where all of this started? Where did it begin? Yeah, it began in Bethlehem. That should be a familiar place to us. Well, Ruth and Boaz in turn had a son, Obed, who in turn had a son named Jesse, who ultimately fathered David, the David who would become king. You remember that prophecy of there shall come a shoot from Jesse's stump? Well, of course, New Testament genealogies also like to trace Jesus' background to that same place through those people. So on its own, it really isn't that eventful a story in some respects, but at the hands of the rabbis and the tradition of Midrash than they represent, it becomes a much, much more interesting story. The various characters all around are treated as conniving and they're less than exemplary. There are all kinds of extra stories about Ruth and Orpah, which speak of them being raped and abused. It's really kind of an unsettling story when you think about it, about what was required in order to create family out of insecurity. So you see, the story we have before us in our biblical text is pretty sanitized. And it's important for us to know that there is a much different interpretation that's out there that's been part of the rabbinic tradition and the rabbinic literature for over a millennia. And I think it's important when we think of Old Testament passages to go to those people who have the most ownership of those passages. So it's a fascinating story. And so when we work through all of that kind of stuff, and we're not going to deal with all of that today, it still does pose a question before us. Again, with any of these ancient Hebrew narratives, how are we to make any sense of this for our lives today? How do we make sense? Well, today let's consider it this way. When separated from our people, when separated from our family, life is fragile. When separated from our people, when separated from our family, we are very vulnerable. When separated from people, when separated from family, where do we find security? Imagine the plight, even in our own country today, of those who do not have those familial connections and are seeking to enter into retirement or social security. Imagine how difficult it is to deal with the healthcare system if there's not a safety net holding us up. You know, we sometimes forget because of where we live that for many, the safety net is very thin and disaster is just around the corner. And that, I think, is why family, community, connection is so important, and that really is talked about in some amazing ways in this story of Ruth. Now, we create family for ourselves in many different ways when we think about it. Our family may be our blood relatives, or perhaps family is really extended to our friends. For some, for many, family is really the church community because this has become the nexus for all social interaction. I would maintain that it's a very rare person who operates outside of some kind of family system. Why? Because I believe we are at our best when we are connected to a community, however it is that we might define that community. So you see, at the macro, the big level, the story of Ruth is about what it took to establish connections, to maintain family in the midst of a very fragile situation. Regardless of the lack of altruism that we think is present in this story, it's still an important story about the need for connection, the need for community. Now, because of the massive changes in our culture in which we live, the subject of being part, in specifically, of a religious community can sometimes evoke a very critical eye. What was once considered to be culturally normative is now seen by many as absolutely abnormal. Some of the reasons are beyond the control of our religious traditions, but at the same time, a long history of questionable actions by Christians have contributed to the jaundiced eye through which many view religion today. Too often, we are at a place that circles the wagons in order to keep the world at bay, all of this being premised on the notion that everything outside of the church is to be viewed as suspect, if not downright evil. So, friends, it really should not surprise us that many no longer take the church very seriously as a place of community, especially when it appears that those who are on the inside are really not able to talk about the institution with any level of honesty. And you know my bias. I would not be doing what I do if I believed that the faith community had nothing to offer. Our communities can indeed make a difference. Last week, remember I alluded to John Wesley's rules, do no harm, do good, stay in love with God. Great advice, don't you think? Well, part of our rootedness in community is rehearsed every time we receive a person into membership in a congregation. It's really an act of community. I have never liked the term membership because the action that we take is really much more of an establishing of a covenantal relationship, one with each other. It's not about signing on a dotted line. It's about a promise that we make that we are going to live in community because we believe community is essential, it's important. And every time we pronounce that ritual, the task is outlined in a certain way. Overall, what it asks us to do is to be people who are not closed off, but instead people who are open-armed and generous. That's what this covenant is about. And we are told that we hold each other up. We make this covenant saying that we're going to support this community, this family, by our prayers, our presence, our gifts, our service, as well as our witness. Our commitment to these ideals is really a commitment to being generous people. It's a commitment to saying that the religious life is both about an inward journey as well as an outward connected journey. So what do each of those things mean? Well, to uphold with prayer, I like to believe that's pretty straightforward. We pray for each other. That's what we're called to do as a community that cares for each other. We pray all the while thinking, how might I be able to make a difference in this person's life for whom I'm praying or this situation for which I'm praying? The reason I say that, because God's work is most often accomplished through us and through our actions. Then we say, we promise presence, the one with a C, not a present, presence. And it means when we make this covenant that we believe that actually participating in worship and study and fellowship events should be a priority in our lives. In simple terms, it reminds us that to be family, to be community, it cannot be done unless we are participating, unless we are engaged. And we pledge our gifts. Well, we know about that. Right now, we are in the middle of our giving campaign, talking about how we support the congregation. And one of the covenantal relationships we have with each other is that we realize that it is us working together that puts in place the finances that support the work, the mission, and the ministry of the congregation. Where does this find its roots? Well, we may remember in the stories of the early church, the first century, they actually held all of that in common. All things were held in common. Could you imagine how that would drive our politicians nuts today? This notion of everything needing to be held in common. And yes, there are those who will quickly remind us and suggest that it was a failed experiment. But what we cannot forget is that's where Christianity began, in its desire to share, to be connected by one another. It's a reminder that when we faithfully give, everything that is the church can happen in abundance. Now, our service both to the church as well as to the larger community is one of the ways we are in covenant with each other, because we say that the various talents we have work together in order to make a profound difference. Sharing our gifts, I believe, connects us to each other as well as creates those places where we can experience a synergy that results from individuals working toward a common cause. Think about every time Stop Hunger Now takes place. What happens when all of those individuals come together in one place? Or think of what happens when we do a health kit build. Or think of what happens when individuals come together to serve a breakfast at People Assisting the Homeless. Or when a group of individuals comes together that are committed to Habitat for Humanity and they build a home. See, this is what being in service is about. We're saying that's an integral a part of being in community. And what's really important about this is the fact that this is not just any other community. It's a community where we find our basis in God and following Jesus. And that's why we say part of our job is to witness to that fact. To be open in our understanding that because God is a part of my life, I'm a different person. And that because I've made an intentional choice to be a follower of Jesus, I'm trying my best to live my life in a different way. And as a community, we are trying our best to live in a different way. We believe when we do this, that is how our lives find their deepest meaning and purpose. When we focus on living in the way for which I believe we were created. The story of Ruth, with all its intricacies and its intrigue, reminds us that community and family are absolutely critical in weaving the fabric of life. For a whole host of reasons that sometimes are self-serving, as well as altruistic, looking for the greater good. We're part of a tradition which emphasizes that our rootedness is also best found in community. And friends, if we take nothing else away from this book of Ruth, it should be a question. The question is, where do I find family and community? Do I make my faith community a priority? That's a question that is posed to each of us. And when we think about it, the choice that we make is not a minor one. It is profound. So friends, where do we find ourselves? Amen.
Westwood United Methodist Church is located at 10497 Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles, between Westwood Village and Beverly Hills. Sundays are at the heart of this faith community's life, and we invite you to worship every Sunday at 10 a.m. A wide variety of opportunities for all ages are also available every week. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.westwoodumc.org or call the church office at area code 310-474-4511. I'm Janet Hoskins. Westwood United Methodist Church. Do justice, love kindness, walk humbly with God.